Hello, everybody, and welcome to another FlyAnglersOnline.com podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Hugo Gibson. This week, my guest is Brian Chan. He is an expert on fly fishing still waters for trout, and he's going to share with us some of his knowledge thanks to some very good questions from you guys who posted on FlyAnglers Online. So please help me welcome Mr. Brian Chan. How are you doing this evening, Brian?
I'm doing great, Hugo.
Excellent, excellent. So tell me just a little bit about what got you into fly fishing, and then maybe what got you headed down the road of specializing in stillwater fishing techniques.
Well, I think just for fly fishing, my roots in fishing were just the fascination as a young child, and a very keen angler was my father, and so we fished every weekend. And I think my fascination with fly fishing started at a very young age when Dad used to subscribe to Outdoor Life back then, and I would be reading those magazines as a young boy, and I saw an article on there about catching fish on flies, and it kind of piqued my interest, and at a very young age, it grew from there. And so from a very young age, I knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. My addiction to fishing, I wanted to be an ichthyologist, a person that studies fish. And so, I just love fishing so much. So my education and my resulting career was, managing the water trout fisheries as a fisheries biologist. So that's why I spend so much time and have such a passion for fishing lakes, is because, I work and breathe them for 35 years, basically.
I've recently moved up to Montana. I didn't do a whole lot of stillwater fishing for trout at all, really, ever. I moved up to Montana just over a year ago. I live in north central Montana, a town called Haver. And just outside of town, we've got two lakes that are fed by a creek that come out of the mountains. And it has been, I tell you, some of the best fishing I've ever had. I really have had the privilege of fishing around the world. And this is, it's incredible. I can't believe how good the fishing is on lakes. I still enjoy moving water, but boy, I'm really starting to get into fishing still waters. So this is going to be a fun podcast for me. I'm really looking forward to getting into some of your knowledge and learning a few things.
The world of stillwater fly fishing is obviously completely fascinating for me.
Mm-hmm.
And like it is any type of fishing, but it can be very intimidating to someone that hasn't fished lakes, particularly if you've spent your entire fishing career on moving water. Coming to standing water, it's a big adjustment, and you have to kind of rethink your approach, but it all makes sense biologically, so you can, just like approaching rivers or streams, streams or rivers from a biological point of view, you do it with the same with lakes, and you break down the lake into the different habitats that the trout live or feed or rest in, and then you go from there.
Do you want to kind of cover the different habitats first and then get into the questions?
That's a great idea.
Okay.
Hugo, because it's important to understand the biology of lakes, the structure, the morphometry of lakes. So, if you took a cross-sectional view of a lake, you start off at the edge of the lake or the riparian vegetation in the shallow areas, which gradually deepen but are still quite shallow. When we call that the littoral or shoal zone of a lake.
Okay.
And then the lake will drop off, the bottom will drop off into the deep water zone of the lake. And it's that littoral zone or shoal area of the lake, which works out to be about water 20 to 25 feet in less, that becomes such an important factor when fishing lakes. And the reason that is because that water 20, 25 feet in less, and where the bottom is there, the sunlight's energy can penetrate to the bottom and allow photosynthesis to produce green plant life, aquatic, submerged, emergent plant life, which is the habitat for many of the food sources of trout, as well as habitat for juvenile trout and adult trout as well. So that leafy green vegetation that grows off the bottom of the lake and sometimes protruding through the water, it is the choice real estate for feeding. And, that's why we need to understand that. And that's why we spend, as anglers, so much time on the shoal or the edge of the drop-off where that shallow water drops off into the deep water zone. So the deep water zone of the lake is also an important part of a lake. It's the refuge. When it gets too warm on the shoals or shallow water, the fish will slide off the shoals into the deeper water where the water is cooler and better oxygenated. And the deep water zone also supports specific insect hatches, such as midges or chironomids from deep water. And then also in the spring and fall, it can be an important area where water boatmen and back swimmer go on mating and swarming flights and will actually dive into that deep water area of the lake. So understanding or selecting lakes that have abundant shoal or shallow areas and also some deep water refuge will go a long way in picking a lake that's going to be quite productive in terms of growing fish.
Mm-hmm.
And as anglers, all we have to do, you know, if we're looking for big fish, is you match lake productivity information to regulations that are on a lake, and you can see which ones and stocking rates that they're stocked, you know, which lakes are going to support big fish or which lakes will be supporting small fish.
Right. Excellent. Well, that's interesting. You know, one of the first times I fished, the locals around here call it Second Lake. It's a little bit further up into the mountains. It's the second lake that you come to when you're driving in. And one of the first times I fished it, I was astounded to see the mayfly hatch coming off. It looked like raindrops on that water where the trout were taking mayflies on the surface. It seriously was the best dry fly fishing I have had ever anywhere. I fished until my arms ached, man. It was incredible. But obviously it's not always like that. And it's interesting listening to you talk about the edge of that drop-off and where the vegetation is. That is where I have caught. I've tootled around that lake in my float tube for days and days and days, and that has by far been the most productive fishing that I've come across. I use a sink tip line on a 4-weight, and I've tried the deep water stuff. Of course, I'm still pretty infantile in my knowledge of stillwater fishing, but I never had as much luck as I did fishing that drop-off zone. So it's interesting to kind of put two and two together, for me anyway. So.
Absolutely. Well, that's the grocery store.
Yeah.
This is a drop-off in shallower. And in many of the lakes that we fish in the Kamloops, British Columbia area where I'm from,
uh-huh.
where there's literally hundreds and hundreds of lakes, you know, we spend the majority of our time in water less than 20 feet in depth, and lots of it is less than 12 feet. You know, the bugs are coming off huge, huge midge or chironomid hatches. Calabasas maize are coming off there. The damsels, the dragons, the caddis all come off from that shallow water.
Yep. Yeah, it's been interesting to start piecing that puzzle together. So, all right. Well, let's get into the questions. The first question that I have is from H. Lorson, and he says, how do you attach a dropper to a floating fly without getting it all tangled up? And what flies do you use related to water temperature or time of the season?
Well, actually, I don't have that much experience fishing with droppers. I have fished them in years past, but in British Columbia, we can only fish with one fly, and so we can't use them. But when we go to other provinces or states, we certainly fish them, and I often will hang the dropper off an improved clinch knot off the bend of the hook, even if it's a dry fly. I think the secret to not getting tangled up when you're fishing lakes, and you've got two flies on, and you may also have a strike indicator on, is you don't want to be double hauling. You don't want nice, tight, narrow casting loops. You want to open things up, slow things down, so you're almost lobbing the fly out so that you see the distinct splashes of the two flies hitting the water. Or if you have an indicator on with two flies under it, then you see the indicator and then a splash of the first fly and a splash of the second fly.
Right.
So slow the cast down, open up your loops, and because the majority of fishing situations in lakes, we're not looking at distance casting. It can be 30 feet from the boat, and that's plenty.
Next question is from Thor Arena. I think I'm pronouncing that right. If I'm not mistaken, he's from the Netherlands, or Iceland, I think it is where he's from. But he says, do nymphs and other insects stay in different depths in the water column? And if it is so, for how long a time do they stay at a given depth, and what influences this? And then he also wants to know, what triggers a hatch? Is it air temperature, water temperature, sunshine, air pressure? What is it?
Those are great questions. And I think the basic, in a nutshell, Hugo, water temperature drives the lake.
Okay.
And it drives insect development, maturation, and emergence. And that's why we have a progression of hatches in lakes that always start off first with midges or chironomids, which are followed by mayflies, damselflies, caddisflies, dragonflies. You'll always see midge hatches in the spring before anything else. And that's just the way their development goes. it all depends on water temperature. And certainly aquatic insects, whether they're in the larval stage, nymphal stage, or pupal stage, inhabit different depths in the water column. So I guess to give you an example, one of the most prolific and enjoyable insect emergence to fish in still waters are midges, or we call them chironomids up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they're such prolific and abundant emergence, different sizes and colors, and literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them coming off every day. But those chironomid pupa, when they break out of their larval tube at the bottom of the lake, which could be in 10 feet of water or 30 feet of water, if the water temperature isn't quite perfect, they will stage within about 3 feet of the bottom of the lake for days and not make that pupal ascent to the surface until they're completed their maturation, which is dictated by water temperature. And it's the same with mayfly nymphs. If they're ready, mature mayfly nymphs, they're swollen wing pads, they're sitting on the vegetation on the bottom of the shoal, and if they're not quite ready to go because they're not, water temperature isn't just perfect, then they just sit it and wait until it's right, and then they'll do their emergence, swim to the surface of the lake. So, based on the actual insects, that would determine where their larval, nymphal, or pupal stages are in relation to the lake bottom. And obviously, in most situations, they're on the bottom and then either rising up vertically to the water column like chironomids or midges, or doing an ascent to the surface based on a swimming motion on an angle to the surface of the lake.
Now, do you find, just for my own information or lack thereof, most of the insects, now, do they hang on the vegetation itself, or do they burrow, or does it just depend on the insect itself?
Yeah, it depends on the insect, but just in a nutshell, chironomid or midge larvae live in the mud-water interface at the bottom of the lake, in little tubes.
Okay.
And the larvae live in those tubes. The nymphs of mayflies, the larvae of caddisflies, the nymphs of damselflies and dragonflies all live amongst the bottom substrate and vegetation of the lake, but they don't burrow, they don't live in tubes at the bottom. They're free crawling or free swimming.
Okay.
In and amongst the vegetation.
Okay, so from Duckster Man, he wants to know, what's your preferred way of fishing chironomids?
Well, if we had all night to talk about chironomids, I mean, obviously that's what I love to fish in, and for many, many reasons. Simply because, as I just mentioned, they're such a prolific hatch. But my preferred way really is I like to watch a strike indicator. I like to fish with indicators.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being that an indicator, with a strike indicator, you can set the precise depth that the pupa are going to fish. And the trout can be extremely selective in the depth zone that they'll eat the chironomid pupa. As an example, if it's 15 feet deep, we don't know where the pupa are going to be eaten by the trout.
Mm-hmm.
What the trout don't do is eat a few chironomids at 14 feet, then swim up to 6 feet, eat a few, then go back to 9 feet, eat a few more, and then go back down to 12 feet.
Yeah.
Animals want to utilize the least amount of energy for the greatest intake of food.
Correct.
Because for them, it's all about survival. And it's a lot safer for fish, particularly trout, to feed closer to the bottom of the lake than higher in the water column, just simply to avoid predators.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even more evident when we're fishing clear water lakes. So if it's 15 feet deep, what typically happens with a chironomid emergence is that the trout will only want to eat the chironomid pupa between 14 and 13 feet, or 13.5 feet and 12 feet. And it's a very narrow horizontal depth zone. So by using a strike indicator, you can find the depth they're in, and then you can suspend your flies in the zone that the fish are feeding in. And that's why they can be so effective.
Excellent. Well, how do you go about finding that depth?
Well, the depth of water, or
the depth that the fish to start fishing.
The rule of thumb is you start fishing chironomid pupa regardless of the technique you're going to use, whether it's floating line indicator, floating line long sinking leader, or full sinking line, you want to start fishing them within a foot of the bottom of the lake.
Okay.
Wherever, regardless of where you're fishing.
Okay.
And chances are that in 95% of the time that you're fishing them, those trout will be eating the pupa within a couple feet of the bottom of the lake.
Well, that is, I'm going to have to try that. I haven't fished with an indicator.
It's an incredibly effective way to fish lakes.
I've had so much fun fishing dry flies and then streamers as well. I haven't even tried any wet flies or nymphs at all. So this, I'm going to have to give it a try. When I broke my wrist a couple weeks ago, so I'm out of fishing for about another month, but as soon as I can, you can bet I'm going to be trying to make up for some lost time, so I'll have to give that a shot.
Oh, absolutely. We fish a lot of different food sources under strike indicators, and we're extremely successful with them.
Oh, that's good to know. I'm one of those guys that hates to use them, but the last couple of people that I've interviewed, that's one of the most effective ways. I interviewed a couple of days ago Rick Haefeli. And he was talking about nymph fishing with an indicator. Oh, man. I'm going to have to change my ways, I think.
Yeah.
Just suck it up.
Yeah, some people are very one way or the other on that, very distinctly. And I mean, watching an indicator for me, it takes you back to when you were a child fishing off the wharf with a white and red plastic bubble float with a worm underneath.
Yeah.
And watching that bobber go up and down while we're just doing the same thing.
Yeah, well, that's no joke. All right, new to the fly wants to know, what is the best way to weed proof a fly, and will this way work with all sized flies?
Well, I think if you need to make a fly weedless, it's most likely going to be a subsurface fly like a dragonfly nymph, damselfly nymph, or even a caddis creeper if you're trying to retrieve it through a lot of vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to weed proof of it is with using some hard monofilament as the weed guard, you know, tying it in at the bend of the hook and bringing it up to just behind the eye of the hook so that it deflects the weeds as the fly is being moved through the water.
Okay.
That would be the best way to do it. And if it was a popper that you were fishing on the surface for bass and you're going through a lot of heavy vegetation, you do the same thing, just with a lot of using very stiff monofilament. The stiffer the monofilament as you get bigger with hook size.
Right. Tyrone Fly has got a pretty good question here. He's got a couple questions, actually. He says, when fishing deep, does Brian prefer a full sinking line, a sinking tip, or other, and why? And then
okay, go ahead, question.
I'll let you answer that one, and then I'll go through the other ones, too.
Sure. So I personally don't use, the only sink tip line that I use myself is the Real Midge tip, which is a full floating line with a 1 meter tip of clear intermediate sinking line. So it's only a 3 foot section. I don't use 10, 15 foot sink tips. I prefer to use either a full sinking line or a full floating line. So the lines that I obviously carry with me when I'm in the boat are a type 1 slow / intermediate sinking line. I carry a type 3, which is like 3 inches per second. And then I'll carry a type 6 or preferably a type 7.
Mm-hmm.
Which is six or seven inches per second. And depending on, you know, what I'm trying to imitate, those are the three go-to lines for me.
Okay. Next part of his question, he says, how does one determine what fly to use in deeper waters on an unfamiliar lake? He says, I find midge patterns work really well along the shoreline at around sunrise and sunset, but after that, I have a devil of a time figuring out what will make them strike. Any suggestions?
Well, certainly, if you're finding midge patterns, particularly pupa patterns working along the shoreline at sunrise and sunset, or even adults, then there's got to be chronom hatching on the shoals during daylight hours, during that 9 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon period. And there could be chronomids, which occur in many lakes I fish, that are coming off or emerging in deep water, like 35, 40 feet of water. I think you always have to be observant and always looking in the water, on the water, watching for birds, which are going to give you the telltale signs that a bug hatch or insect emergence is underway. And so, you know, if it's an unfamiliar lake, what I often suggest is if it's a new lake, then hop in your boat, your canoe, float tube, pontoon boat, and just little off fast sinking line with a leech pattern, woolly bugger, or dragonfly nymph, which are all common food sources of productive still waters. And, you know, check the lake around. Check around and see where the shoals are, where the sunken islands are, where the drop-offs are, and you'll see bugs and you'll emerging, and it just helps narrow down or helps you figure out that jigsaw puzzle a lot quicker.
You also had another question. When fishing still waters, is it best to fish just below the surface, mid-column, or near the bottom?
Yeah, you've got to be prepared to, you know, for instance, if it's mayflies or caddis pupa, you know, the caddis pupa swim from the bottom of the shoal on a 30, 40 degree angle to the surface of the lake, and so trout can eat them anywhere on their pupa swim to the surface of the lake, and that's why you have to match sinking lines or floating lines and long leaders so that you're covering that whole spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
But again, in many situations, the trout will want to eat the mayfly nymphs or the caddis pupa or the damselfly nymphs closer to the bottom than higher in the water column.
Really good to know. Now, you mentioned long leaders. How long is your average leader?
Well, it depends. If we're fishing floating line and a lead long and a sinking leader without an indicator, and we're fishing the drop-off in, then we want to have a leader at least 25% longer than the depth of water we're fishing. So, for instance, if we're fishing in 15 feet of water and we want to fish floating line long leader, then and doing retrieves, these are based on anchored boat casting and retrieving,
mm-hmm.
then we'd need a leader at least 20 feet in length.
Wow.
So that allows the line cast out, the fly to sink, the leader to sink, and when you start your retrieve, we're never going to be retrieving that fly when it's perfectly perpendicular to the floating line. It's always going to be coming in on an angle because we're pulling it.
Right.
So we need that longer leader to ensure our fly can cover that bottom area of the lake.
Okay, well, I'm glad I asked that question because I would have got that completely wrong. Lady Fisher, she's actually the owner of the website. She says that she's been reading a British book that her nephew Tom Travis brought back from his latest trip to the Dutch Fly Fair. And she would like your take on fishing soft hackles in the first few inches of the lake surface.
We use soft hackle maize, caddis pupa, and they can be extremely effective. And I think soft tackles are a highly missed opportunity that anglers don't take advantage of, because there is a lot of feeding that can occur just subsurface,
uh-huh.
where the fish just don't want to take partially emerged or fully emerged insect, and they want to just, you know, within a couple of inches of the surface, and that's where those soft tackles really come in. And it is a form of fishing that deserves more attention in still waters.
Now, do you fish those with a shorter leader under a strike indicator?
Absolutely.
Or?
Yeah, so if you're fishing soft tackles, depending on the clarity of the water, I'd be fishing with at least a 12-foot leader.
Okay.
Maybe even longer, depending on how clear the water is, just to distance yourself from the your fly line.
Right. Okay, that's good to know. When fishing a new lake or a reservoir, this is, I think, from Ducksterman again, I said, when fishing a new lake or reservoir with a floating device, like a float tube or out of a boat, with no prior knowledge of it, what would be your approach, the flies, lines, depths, etc.?
Well, again, if I was going on to a lake I'd never been on before, I would start kicking out or rowing out from shore and finding where all the shallow water is and where the edges of the drop-offs are. And I would be concentrating on the water from the edge of the drop-off shallower, because that's where 90% of the feeding is going to occur. At the same time, I'll always be scanning the water to look for jumping fish, moving fish. And if they're just free jumping 2 feet out of the water, that's fine. They're not eating necessarily, but they're telling you that there's a fish there, probably got some buddies with them, and they're active. They may not be feeding right then, but at least they're there. They give away their presence. And it also tells you that they are swimming around a bit looking. It can be very tough when you approach any lake, whether it's for the first time or the 100th time, and there's no fish moving, no fish jumping, because it tells you they're not active.
Okay.
And it's a great benefit to get to a piece of water and see fish moving.
From Ducksterman, he says, if you are targeting trophy trout, would you change your tactics? And if so, how would you do it?
So obviously, for targeting bigger fish, then I'll make the shit off. Obviously, be double checking all my knots and my hook. I will definitely be using fluorocarbon for at least the last two pieces of my leader. I mean, the last 4 or 5 feet of my leader will be definitely be quality fluorocarbon. So we get fine diameter, lots of strength, and less visibility in the water. And I'm double checking my knots just to make sure I haven't tied one wrong. That I have no wing knots, no casting knots in my leader. Checking that on a regular basis.
Okay. Now, do you change anything as far as your fishing techniques themselves don't change so much, just the equipment that you use?
No. You're fishing, I mean, if it's a chronomid hatch in the lake, then I'm fishing chronomids. And whatever, you know, I wouldn't change my habits, you know, but I'm just making sure everything's in good shape when I actually go fishing, because if you catch a 15, 16, 17-pound rainbow, you want to make sure your equipment's all good order.
Yes, I will agree with you there. Ray, and I'm going to try his last name, Coons, I think is how it's pronounced, wants to know, what is the best technique for fishing in deeper water when smaller ponds start to warm up in the summer? Is trolling the only answer, or should I consider a drifting and jigging technique?
So, smaller ponds, when they start to warm up in the summer, what happens is that the water on the shore during the daytime becomes too warm for the trout because they're cold-blooded. So they'll seek cooler water that's more oxygenated. So trolling will certainly allow you to cover the water quickly on a small pond. You could also be anchoring and casting in deep water. And I should add that regardless of the size of the lake you're fishing, you should always have a depth sounder with you. They're relatively inexpensive. So I'm talking about depth sounder fish finder. They tell you the depth of water. I'll tell you the surface temperature you get with a temperature gauge in it, and they'll mark fish, and they'll tell you where the fish are sitting at what depth in that deep water. Of course, it's imperative that if you're going to use a depth sounder, that you take the time to read the instructions so that you calibrate it and fine-tune it so that when you actually see a fish icon that you can believe that it is a fish.
Right.
But I never leave home without my depth sounder.
I don't have one, but the lakes that I'm fishing are fairly deep, so I can see where one of those would definitely come in handy.
Oh, yeah, no, they're a critical piece of equipment.
Ducksterman again, he wants to know how important you think water boatman flies are. Do you ever use them as a searching pattern, or only reserve them for when there's obvious boatman activity?
I'll use boatman basically 3 times a year. Right at ice off, water boatmen and back swimmers are quite active. That's because it just endured, in my area, 5 to 6 months of ice cover. It survived it under the ice, and they're quite active. So they are an available food source right at ice off for very hungry trout. They're a go-to fly at ice off. And then in the spring months, mid-spring, water boatmen and back swimmers will go on swarming flights. They'll fly from one body of water to another body of water. You'll know that they're doing that because you'll see raindrops hitting the water on a nice sunny day, and it's boatmen and back swimmers hitting the water, so fish them then. The most fun time to fish water boatmen and their cousins, the back swimmer, are in the mid to late fall period. After you've had a heavy frost, nice, calm, sunny September, October day, not a cloud in the sky, and she'll start raining. And the raindrops are boatmen and back swimmers that are flying from one body of water to the body of water you're on to mate and deposit eggs, and that can be a great time to fish them. So you can actually fish them 3 times in a year. I don't normally go out in the middle of summer, like if I was going to go out tomorrow to a lake, and I wouldn't normally put on a water boatman or back swimmer.
Okay.
I'd reserve them for that ice off, mid-spring, late fall.
TB Wannabe, I'm guessing that stands for Trout Bum Wannabe, wants to know how you would fish Forest Lake, British Columbia.
No, I think TB is referring to the Forest Lake just north of Williams Lake, between Williams Lake and Quesnel. And it's a great piece of water, which I fished many, many years ago before it got real, real, real popular. And I still like to go there. It's got an amazing chronomid hatch. And the Forest Lake has some monstrous fish in it. Numerous fish in excess of 10 pounds. It's a very good trophy fishery. But it does get busy. So I love to go there in the spring, last 2 weeks of May, depending on how late or early spring is. Take in the chronomid hatch. But I really like to fish forest late in the fall, like October, early to late October. are a great fall pattern. So spring and fall are the times of year to be on that beautiful piece of water.
T-Lerm from Greenwood, Missouri, has got a couple questions for you. He says, what is your go-to fly for still water and how do you fish it?
You know, my go-to flies, you got to give me two choices. If it's in the spring, my go-to fly is going to be Chronomet.
Uh-huh.
And it would be, only had one color to choose, it would be black body, red wire rib with a white metal bead for the gills, for the cone head, to obtain the gills.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be fishing them on floating lines, whether it's under an indicator or just long leader fishing without an indicator. And in the fall, definitely the go-to fly will be a small micro leech, either maroon or black color. And it could be as small as 12 2X, even 14 2X.
Wow.
And trout love them in the fall.
Interesting. I never would have guessed that. Huh. What size, when you're talking about chironomids, what size hook are you tying those on? Or does it vary?
Everything from a 16 scud hook to 8 3X.
Holy cow. Wow.
But they get very large in interior British Columbia. 10 3X is quite common. We call them bombers when they get that big. It's a big morsel.
Okay.
And the adults are that big as well.
Wow. I don't know that I've seen any quite that big.
That's
pretty good.
You tend to see bigger ones the further north in latitude you go.
Second part of his question is, how and where does Brian fish his baby damsel? How deep, near the shoreline only, etc.?
So my baby damsel basically is it's a marabou, one marabou bodied with a marabou tail.
Uh-huh.
And it's tied on a 14 scud hook with a extra small gold bead.
Mm-hmm.
And a silver or gold wire rib. Trout love to eat baby damsels or juvenile damselfly nymphs in the fall. So I like to fish them in the fall, and I like to hang them under an indicator, and I'll fish them in the openings of the long stem bulrush or cattails.
Uh-huh.
So you'll have a big shoal coming out in the lake, and then you'll have an irregular patchwork of emergent vegetation, long stem bulrush or cattails, and there'll be open water patches. Little openings of holes in there, and I like to cast a fly under an indicator, suspend it about 8 to 10 inches off the bottom, and let it sit in that opening and hold on.
So you don't give the fly any action, you just let it sit there?
If there's a breeze, it'll bob up and down. The fly's tied on with a non-slip loop knot, so it's undulating and dancing under there very seductively,
mm-hmm.
and that's often all it takes. If it's a big opening where I can actually cast it and do some retrieve, then I would certainly do some very slow retrieve of the fly through that opening.
Okay.
But I want to keep the fly close to the bottom.
Okay. Yeah.
So it could be, we could be fishing in 5 feet of water or 8 feet of water or 10 feet of water and hanging it down, hanging the fly within a foot of the bottom.
And then he says, third part is, I think I've seen Brian use an indicator that slips down the leader when the leader is under tension. Is it a special type of indicator you use, or does it just require special rigging?
So these are called quick-release indicators
uh-huh.
that are available at fly shops. And why we use those quick-release indicators is because we use them when we're fishing deep water. So, for instance, if we're hanging more than 12 feet under your indicator, so like 18, I'll hang up to 25 feet of leader under an indicator. So when you're hanging, like if you're spending a chironomid pupa or a leech pattern 18 feet under your indicator, and it was fixed, indicator with a toothpick, cocktail toothpick that's pegged,
mm-hmm.
right? Or if it was a yarn one and it's looped over onto your fly line, it's immovable. And you can't, unless you pull the toothpick or adjust the yarn loop, you can't get your fish and fly within 18 feet of the boat because you got all that leader.
Oh.
So when you use a quick release indicator, the indicator triggers, the peg releases, and the indicator and peg slide down your leader so that you can basically wind in right to your fly.
Okay.
So they're little styrofoam ball or teardrop shaped things, and they're very common at least West Coast fly shops.
Okay, that's good. I can't say that I've ever seen or heard of one of those. But
very popular in Washington, Oregon.
Okay.
And certainly British Columbia, Alberta.
Interesting. I might have to check those out. Last question's from Crunchy. He wants to know, what has been your overall most productive color?
You know, I think I'd have to say maroon. Maroon is, of course, I'm referring, you know, to maroon-colored leeches, even maroon-colored chironomid pupa. That maroon is a deadly color in lakes. Quite visible at depth,
mm-hmm.
and it's just a very fish-catchy color.
I've read any of the red color spectrum that maroon. Purple as well, I've heard, is a pretty good color.
Purple's another, yep.
So that's interesting that that's one of your most productive colors. Well, Brian, that's all I have for you this evening.
We covered a lot of information. I hope the listeners get a sense of the importance of understanding the structure of a lake and where the fish live in that, why they live in that shallower water, and why we should be spending so much time there.
It makes a lot more sense to me now. I've done a lot of fishing from shore, and of course that's where I'm going to be catching the majority of my fish, and then I'm in my float tube as well. And they've all been close to shore. I mean, I've caught a few fish out in the deeper water, but it's certainly, listening to you explain it like that, makes a lot more sense why I've been catching most of my fish closer to shore and along the drop-offs. So,
yeah. No, it's, you got to go where they're living.
Yeah,
and, that's true. The only thing that kicks the fish out of that shallow water is water temperature. It's too warm in the summer months. Warmer water supports less oxygen. They need cool, well-oxygenated water. They have to leave.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing stopping them from coming back at night to feed in that shallow water during the hot summer period. And you can have some very good nighttime fishing right about now. Like today in Kamloops, you know, we hit about 92 Fahrenheit. Bit of a cook of the day, but you'd still catch fish, you know, on the edges of the drop-offs for sure, where the water's a little bit cooler.
Mm-hmm. What, just quickly, if you know, what is that you find is usually that key temperature where the fish start to head down to deeper water?
Well, maybe a better way to answer that is that the prime range of water temperature for feeding, for actively feeding fish on the shoal and edges of the drop-offs is in Fahrenheit between about 50 degrees Fahrenheit and 67 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
Once you get above 68, 69, 70, it's gotten a little too warm and they'll leave the shallow water and slip off into deeper stuff.
Okay. And then when go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, when you take a water temperature reading, do you take it from the surface, or do you drop a thermometer down into deeper water and take it down there?
Surface. I take, you know, 6 inches under the surface.
Okay. That's good to know. Interesting.
It's a good reference point. You know, if the surface temperature, you know, 6 inches under is 72 degrees, she's going to be too hot.
Okay.
You know, for a lot of shoal activity.
Right.
Okay. You know, shallow water, you know, it's not going to be comfortable for those trout.
Excellent.
And you better start poking around the edges of the drop-off, and that's why that depth sounder can be your very valued friend on the water.
Mm-hmm.
Start cruising around the edges of the drop-off, and you'll mark fish.
Excellent.
Sitting, you know, 15 to 17 feet down, just above the thermic line where the water is cool and well-oxygenated.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting out and trying some of these techniques when I can finally get this wrist healed up and usable again. I'm sure it's going to be...
Yeah, well, I wish you a speedy recovery on that. Hopefully, for sure, Hugo, you want to experiment with strike indicators.
Yeah, I'm going to have to. I think there's not going to be much getting around it if I want to try some of these other techniques. So, thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your evening to sit and chat with me. Really, really appreciate it. And
anytime, Hugo. Hope listeners enjoyed this.
Real quick, do you have a website? If somebody wants to order anything from you or check on classes that you're giving, et cetera, do you have a website that they can go to?
Yeah, I have a website, Hugo. It's www.riseform, R-I-S-E-F-O-R-M, flyfishing, all one word, .com.
Okay.
Riseformflyfishing.com.
Well, thanks again. Hope you have a great evening and tight lines this summer.
You too, Hugo.
Thanks, Brian. Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us for another FlyAnglersOnline.com podcast. The next one is going to be pretty special for me. I'm going to be interviewing the one and only AK Best. So stay tuned for that one. Should be up pretty quick. Should be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. Until then, tight lines.